From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The new media are thriving, the old media are dying. That seems to be the theme of our program from week to week to week. But, of course, it's much more complicated than that because increasingly the old and new are merging into one another. This week we're devoting the program to the oldest of old media, books. Chances are you'll be buying one or two this holiday season, but where and how you'll buy them and in what form are open questions.
Nowadays, some 60% of all books are not bought in brick-and-mortar bookstores. They're purchased at airports or checkout counters, Walmart or Costco, Toys R Us or Williams-Sonoma or online. In case you were wondering, 11% are purchased from Amazon.com. The rest are bought at bookstores, but mostly the big chains. The membership of the American Booksellers Association, which serves independent bookstores, has dropped from more than 5,000 to roughly 1,700 in the last decade. Should we decry the state of publishing today?
One of the reasons why it's fashionable or why it's common to decry its state is because most of the major publishing houses are now owned by conglomerates and foreign conglomerates at that.
Sarah Nelson is editor-in-chief of Publishers Weekly.
And they're publicly traded companies for the most part, so there is a demand on the part of editors and publishers to have double-digit growth. You know, it used to be a rich family owned a publishing house, and they published books because they wanted to publish them, not because they expected to make 12%. I mean, in those days, private equity was Nelson Doubleday opening his checkbook.
But nowadays, publishers put their muscle behind books that can sell themselves, and corporate chains like Barnes & Noble and Borders reserve their precious real estate for the highest rollers.
The books on the front table in the stores and the books on the front page of Amazon also, and other online retailers, they don't just get there because somebody liked them. They get there because they were paid by the publisher for a certain kind of distribution. They call it co-op, and it's product placement, basically.
Whereas when you go into an independent bookseller, you are taken care of by a bookseller.
Avan Domnitz is CEO of the American Booksellers Association.
That is the hallmark of the independent bookseller, that they know the material, they know the books, and that they can discuss them with you.
And that fact has not been entirely lost on readers. Both the independents and online sellers like Amazon offer reviews and recommendations, and in fact,
in the last 4 years, the only segments of the book industry that has maintained or increased market share has been online and independent stores.
That share may increase still more with the development of machines that can produce books in a few minutes in stores on demand. We'll be hearing more about that later on. But Domnitz says new hardware will someday shift the balance back to the little guy.
I think it's a great equalizer. One of the things that the chains did is they brought to the world this enormous inventory that most independents had difficulty matching. Having books available in print-on-demand format, you can walk into any bookstore, large or small, and ask for a book, and as long as it's been digitized, any bookstore can get any book at any time.
Or at least they will. But, says Sarah Nelson, that's precisely the problem, the most serious, most insoluble problem confronting the industry today. Too many books.
It depends whether you count self-published books or not, but it's between 200,000 and 300,000 books a year. You see the problem, which is that even people who want to read books can't begin to get to them, let alone how you begin to publicize and market all of those books.
Frankly, I can't see reducing the number of books. That seems, well, un-American. But I can see the difficulty in cutting through the clutter. There are fewer newspaper book reviews, fewer book shows, and a declining number of forums for public discussion, especially of fiction. The term of art for this problem is disintermediation. Not enough mediators. There are fewer of them, at least in print, but there are plenty of them online and in thousands of living room book clubs across America. And there is one on TV that's worth more than all the others combined, a titanic, omnipotent mediator who tries to use her powers for good.
It's the only book I've ever read that when I put it down, I immediately wanted to read it again. Usually I wouldn't.
You know, I look at the bestseller list every year.
Cecilia Conchar-Farr, professor of English at the College of St. Catherine.
And when Oprah's on hiatus, people read fewer novels. And when Oprah chooses novels and recommends them, more novels top the $1 million mark.
Kanchar Farr studied the phenomenon in her book, Reading Oprah, How Oprah's Book Club Changed the Way America Reads.
I'm jealous. I'm jealous that she can get so many people to read the book she says to read, and I can only get 20 or 25 at a time, the students in my class, and it's only because I have a grade book.
Case in point, Jonathan Franzen, whose family drama, The Corrections, was deemed by academics and other cultural arbiters to be a crossover book that would bridge the audiences for both middle and highbrow fiction. They sang its praises and the publisher obliged with a print run of 90,000. Oprah recommended it, a gift horse that Franzen unceremoniously kicked in the teeth.
The literary establishment brought our whole audience to it and got 90,000. Oprah said two sentences and got over 600,000. And 600,000 people buying that book would put it in the realm of the least successful Oprah books. Anna Karenina, when she chose that, it sold almost 1 million copies that year.
Franzen later apologized. He didn't get it. The publishing industry did, but there are other titanic forces at work, other gift horses the industry has not been so quick to recognize. Like Google Library, Google announced that it will include in its database the full text from some of the world's leading research libraries. When doing searches, users will be able to browse the full texts of public domain material, but only a few sentences in books still covered by copyright. They'll see up to 3 snippets, a term that has yet to be defined but has provoked furious debate and 2 lawsuits, one brought by the Authors Guild.
Their attitudes, well, gee, they're making so much money, I'm not making any money. Why should they be allowed to use my work without my permission? Shouldn't they have to pay me? But of course, the fair use doctrine doesn't work that way.
Jonathan Band is an adjunct professor at the Georgetown University Law Center.
What Google is doing is providing a tool that, if anything, will help the publishers. It will make books more relevant than they are today. Because right now, a lot of students, when they are given a research assignment, they just go to Google or another search engine. They don't see books because books are invisible on the internet.
Is there any indication that showing a snippet does hurt the commercial potential of a book? And is there any indication, actually, furthermore, that showing the whole book invariably hurts the potential for selling that book?
So far, if anything, the evidence goes the other way. Some publishers have discovered that the more content that they put online, meaning not just the snippets, but pages or even chapters, that the more readers want to buy the book, that the sampling really does help drive sales.
I think the traditional publishing industry probably serves about 2,000 authors well. Meanwhile, there's 200,000 books published each year. So there's 198,000 authors who really need to find a better way.
Chris Anderson is the editor of Wired and the author of the book and the concept called The Long Tail that predicts, with a steady growth of online sales, that more books will be sold in smaller quantities. The famous example is Touching the Void, a book that languished for years until it soared up the bestseller list on the tail of another book into thin air. All it took was Amazon's observation that people who liked that book might like this other one, too. In these days of disintermediation, marketing is king, free marketing especially, of the kind that occurs online. And Anderson says if you really want to boost sales, make the books free, too. After all, advertiser-supported TV and radio are free, and magazines are so cheap, they might as well be.
Free allows you to maximize your reach. It's basically a form of marketing. And free books get books into the hands of people who wouldn't otherwise read those books.
Yeah, but you don't expect publishers to put ads in books.
Well, I mean, first of all, why not? In the 1950s, Pulp Fiction was all about putting ads in books.
Ick.
And I'm not sure that we shouldn't have a version of the book that is sponsored and could be given away for free by the sponsor.
But he says that's not how most people would buy them. He wouldn't. But why not? He wants options, easy access to out-of-print books, books with ads, books on tape, even e-books, though he doesn't really like them, and digital downloads. He doesn't see a problem with too many books.
You know what? My interests aren't perfectly served by the inventory on the shelves of Walmart. And, you know, thank God I have a choice now.
This week, the National Endowment for the Arts released a new study about reading. It found reading proficiency declining across the board and that nearly half of Americans, ages 18 to 24, read no books for pleasure. Well, the NEA might not like it, but that's a choice too.
Okay, so at the end of the show, we'll play our staff's favorite picks from the 12-word novel challenge we issued 2 weeks ago. We limited ourselves to just 12 winners, imposing the same rules on ourselves as we did on you. And to be honest, we didn't always agree with the staff or each other.
And if the contest had been for great first lines of novels, the winners would have been completely different. So just to whet your appetite for the dozen winning novels to come, we thought we'd throw you a few entries that we consider great first lines.
John loved his apartment. Then his wife discovered it and ruined everything.
Harvey hated that his parents were vampires, so he married a Catholic.
Insanity didn't run in his family, but you have to start somewhere.
Marvin dances for a living. Betty thinks he works odd hours banking.
Actually, that's a movie. That's that Japanese movie that Richard Gere ruined. What was it called? Chowie Dance. Okay. Audience, I had not read this until just now, so I'm going to do my best. Don't bother Frederick while he's playing his cello, said the severed head.
My uncle? All these months, I thought he was your uncle.
That was just a taste.
Thank you, Lori Eckert, Emily D., Mary Spaniel, Lorraine O'Connor, Rosie Jonker, and Jean Newman.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI, to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.